girl. VBAC moms against moms who sign up for a second C-section. Guilt? There's plenty of that to go around. You didn't even try to labor first? Plus a fair amount of shaming and finger-wagging. What? You let your doctor induce you? But the truth is, and it's a truth that really deserves to go viral, there's room for every safe childbirth choice in the birthing room, and there should be no room for judging. Every mom and dad, every labor, every situation is different, and what works for one doesn't necessarily fly with the next. The bottom line that matters, as always, is a healthy mom and baby bottom line, and any choice or circumstance that delivers a safe delivery is a good one, and there's no disputing that.
Making the decision. And now you have the lowdown on pain management and pain relief options for labor and delivery. The information you'll need to make an informed decision. But before you decide what's best for you and your baby, you should discuss pain management and relief options with your practitioner well before that first contraction kicks in. Ask about the options you're considering, what side effects may be experienced when using medication options, under what circumstances medication may be absolutely necessary, and when the choice is all yours. Consider keeping an open mind. Though it's smart to think ahead about what might be best for you under certain circumstances, it's impossible to predict what kind of labor and delivery you'll have and whether or not you'll want or need medication, or even if you'll have access to the type of pain relief you're hoping for. Even if you're absolutely convinced that you want an epidural, you may not want to close the door on some CAM approaches. After all, your labor may turn out to be more manageable or a lot shorter than you thought. And even if you're sold on a med-free delivery, you may want to think about leaving the medication window open, even just a crack, in case your labor turns out to be tougher than you'd bargained for. Most important, remember as you sort through all your options to keep your eye on the bottom line, a bottom line that has a really cute bottom. After all, no matter how you end up managing the pain of childbirth, and even if you don't end up managing it the way you'd plan to or the way you'd really hope to, you'll still manage to give birth to your baby. And what could be a better bottom line than that?
Chapter 12. The eighth month. Approximately 32 to 35 weeks.
In this next to last month, you may still be loving every expectant moment, or you may be growing weary of, well, growing. Either way, you're sure to be preoccupied with and super excited about the much-anticipated arrival of your baby. Of course, along with that heaping serving of excitement, you and your partner may also be experiencing a side of trepidation, especially if this is your first foray into parenthood. Talking those very normal feelings through and tapping into the insights of friends and family members who've preceded you into parenthood will help you realize that everyone feels that way, especially the first time around.
Your baby, the eighth month.
Week 32. This week, your baby is tipping the scales at almost 3.5 to 4 pounds. Think cantaloupe. And topping out anywhere from 16 to 17 inches. And growing isn't the only thing on your little one's agenda these days. While you're busy getting everything ready for baby's arrival, baby's busy prepping for that big debut too. In these last few weeks, it's all about practice, 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 as baby hones the skills needed to survive outside the womb, from swallowing and breathing to kicking and sucking. And speaking of sucking, your little one has been able to suck on a sweet little thumb for a while now. Another change this week, your baby's skin is no longer transparent. As more and more fat accumulates under the skin, it's finally opaque. Week 33. Baby's gaining weight almost as fast as you are these days, averaging out to about 0.5 pound a week, which puts the grand total so far at more than 4.5 pounds. Still, your baby has plenty of growing to do. He or she may grow a full inch this week alone and may come close to doubling in weight by birthday. And with that much baby inside your uterus now, your amniotic fluid level has maxed out. There's no room for more fluid, which explains why those pokes and kicks are sometimes extremely uncomfortable. There's less fluid to cushion the pushing. Antibodies are also being passed from you to baby as your little one continues to develop an immune system of his or her very own. These antibodies will definitely come in handy on the outside and will protect your baby-to-be from a world of germs. Week 34. Your baby could be as tall as 17 to 18 inches right now and weigh nearly 5 pounds, as much as a bag of sugar, only much sweeter. Got mail? A male baby, that is? If you do, then this is the week that his testicles are making their way down from his abdomen to their final destination, his scrotum. About 3 to 4% of boys are born with undescended testicles, which is nothing to worry about. They usually make their trip down south before the first birthday. And in other baby-related news, those tiny fingernails have probably reached the tip of those little fingers by this week. So make sure you have baby nail clippers on your shopping list. Week 35. Your baby stands tall this week, if he or she could stand, that is, at about 18 inches and continues to follow the half pound a week plan, weighing in at about 5 1/4 big ones. While growth will gradually taper off when it comes to height, the average full-termer is born at about 20 inches, your baby will continue to pack on the pounds until delivery day. Something else he or she will be packing on in the few weeks that remain are brain cells. Brain development continues at a mind-boggling pace, making baby a little on the top-heavy side. And speaking of tops, it's likely your baby's bottom is. Most babies have settled into a head-down, bottoms-up position in mom's pelvis by now, or will soon. That's a good thing, since it's easier on you if baby's head, the biggest part of his or her body, exits first during delivery. Here's another plus. Baby's head may be big, but it's still soft, at least the skull is, allowing that tight squeeze through the birth canal to be a little less tight.
Your body, the 8th month.
Here are some symptoms you may experience this month or may not experience since every pregnancy is different. Some of the symptoms may be continuing from last month, while others may be new to the list. Chances are, as your baby load grows and grows, so will your symptom load or overload, with the discomforts of late pregnancy multiplying. Physically, strong, regular fetal activity, increasing vaginal discharge, constipation, heartburn, indigestion, flatulence and bloating, occasional headaches, occasional lightheadedness or dizziness, especially when getting up quickly or when your blood sugar dips, nasal congestion and occasional nosebleeds, ear stuffiness, sensitive gums that may bleed when you brush, leg cramps, backache, achiness in the lower abdomen or along both or either sides, occasional sudden sharp or shock-like sensations in the pelvic area, aka lightning crotch, mild swelling of ankles and feet, and occasionally of hands and face, varicose veins in legs and or vulva, hemorrhoids, itchy belly, protruding navel, a popped-out belly button, stretch marks, increasing shortness of breath as the uterus crowds the lungs, difficulty sleeping, increasing Braxton Hicks contractions, clumsiness, enlarged breasts, colostrum leaking from nipples, though this pre-milk may not appear until after delivery. Emotionally, increasing eagerness for the pregnancy to be over, apprehension about labor and delivery, increasing absent-mindedness, jitters about becoming a parent, excitement at the realization that it won't be long now.
Your body this month. An interesting bit of pregnancy trivia. Measurement in centimeters from the top of your pubic bone to the top of your uterus roughly correlates with the number of weeks you're up to. So, at 34 weeks, your uterus measures close to 34 centimeters from the pubic bone. If you'd like to see any of the illustrations from this chapter, you can download and print out a special PDF from the same Audible page where you purchased your audiobook. What you can expect at the 8th month checkup.
After the 32nd week, your practitioner may ask you to come in every 2 weeks so your progress and your baby's can be more closely watched. You can probably expect the following: weight and blood pressure, urine for protein, fetal heartbeat, height of fundus, top of the uterus, size, you may get a rough weight estimate, and position of the fetus by palpation, feeling from the outside, feet and hands for swelling, and legs for varicose veins, group B strep culture at 35 to 37 weeks, symptoms you have been experiencing, especially unusual ones, questions and problems you want to discuss, have a list ready.
What you may be wondering about, the 8th month.
Braxton Hicks contractions.
Every once in a while, my uterus seems to bunch up and harden. What's going on?
It's practicing. With delivery right around the corner, your body is warming up for the big day by flexing its muscles, literally. Those uterine calisthenics you're feeling are called Braxton Hicks contractions. Practice for labor contractions that usually begin sometime after the 20th week, though they're more noticeable in the last few months of pregnancy. They play a part in pumping up blood flow to the placenta, get ready, toning the muscles of the uterus, get set, and softening the cervix, go, soon. These rehearsal contractions, typically experienced earlier and with more intensity in second and subsequent pregnancies, feel like a tightening sensation that begins at the top of your uterus and then spreads downward, lasting from 15 to 30 seconds, though they can sometimes last as long as 2 minutes or more. If you check out your bump while you're having a Braxton Hicks, you might even be able to see what you're feeling. Your usually round belly might appear pointy or strangely bunched up. Weird to watch, but normal. Though Braxton Hicks contractions are not true labor, they may be difficult to distinguish from real labor, especially as they become more intense, which they often do as pregnancy edges to a close. You may notice them more often when you've got a full bladder, if you're dehydrated, after sex, when you or baby are very active, or even when someone touches your belly. And though they're not efficient enough to deliver your baby, even when they get really uncomfortable, they may give you a leg up on labor by getting effacement and early dilation of the cervix started when the time is right. To relieve any discomfort you may feel when you're getting a Braxton Hicks, try changing your position, lying down and relaxing if you've been on your feet, or getting up and walking around if you've been sitting. A warm bath may also help relieve discomfort. A drink of water may help too. You can also use this labor rehearsal to practice your breathing exercises and the various other childbirth techniques you've learned, which can make the real contractions easier to deal with when they do arrive. If the contractions don't subside with a change in activity, and if they become stronger and more regular, especially if you feel pressure in your lower back, you may be in real labor, so be sure to put in a call to your practitioner. A good rule of thumb, if you have more than 4 Braxton Hicks in an hour, call your practitioner and let him or her know. If you're having a hard time distinguishing Braxton Hicks contractions from the real thing, especially if this is your first pregnancy and you've never experienced the real thing, give your practitioner a call, being sure to describe exactly what you're feeling. Aching ribs.
I keep feeling a dull, achy pain on my side, near my rib cage, almost like my ribs are bruised. Is that because the baby is kicking me?
It may be yet another in the long list of pregnancy pains that have been kicking you in the butt these days. But you can't blame babies kicking for this pain in your ribs. No, those achy, breaky ribs are courtesy of pregnancy hormones, which have been loosening the joints in the area. In some moms-to-be, this loosening causes the ribs to bow out, called subluxated ribs, to make room for the expanded lungs, which need extra oxygen, and an ever-expanding uterus. You may also be feeling the ache because of inflammation of the cartilage attached to the ribs as they loosen and expand, and possibly because of the pressure placed on the ribs by your uterus or larger-than-usual breasts. Or rarely because of a dislocated rib, again because of rib expansion to accommodate your pregnancy. There is some relief in sight. Your ribs may feel less stretched and less achy during the last few weeks of pregnancy when your baby moves down into position for birth, and of course once you deliver. Until then, keep the clothes you're wearing loose so you're not putting more pressure on those aching ribs, especially when you're sleeping or trying to sleep. A pregnancy belly support band can help to evenly distribute the weight of your growing belly, removing the strain off the muscles of the abdomen, which pull on the ribs and cause rib pain. Shifting positions may also lessen your discomfort, as may a warm bath or a heating pad placed over your clothes. Nothing working? Acetaminophen, Tylenol, can help ease the ache. And be sure to avoid heavy lifting, which can make it worse, and which you shouldn't be doing now anyway.
Sometimes I get the feeling like my baby has jammed his feet up into my rib cage, and it hurts.
Occasionally, a baby will manage to wedge a foot into his mama's ribs, and that's one kind of rib tickling that doesn't tickle. You may be able to change your baby's position by changing yours, or by bouncing on a birthing ball. Or you can also try a gentle nudge or a few pelvic tilts to dislodge that little foot. Or try this mama move. Sit up straight and take a deep breath while you raise one arm over your head, then exhale while you drop your arm and repeat with the other arm. Baby's not budging, at least not for long. Sometimes the rib jamming becomes chronic, lasting until your little pain in the ribs engages or drops into your pelvis, which usually happens 2 to 3 weeks before delivery in first pregnancies, though often not until labor begins in subsequent ones. Shortness of breath.
Sometimes I have trouble breathing, even when I'm just sitting doing nothing. Does that mean my baby isn't getting enough oxygen?
It's not surprising you're feeling a little spare on air these days. Your ever-expanding uterus is now crowding out all your other internal organs in an effort to provide spacious enough accommodations for your ever-growing baby. Among those organs feeling the crunch are your lungs, which your uterus has compressed, limiting their ability to expand fully when you take a breath. This, teamed with the extra progesterone that has already been leaving you breathless for months, explains why a trip upstairs these days can make you feel as if you've just run a marathon, winded big time. Fortunately, while this shortness of breath may feel uncomfortable to you, it doesn't bother your baby in the least. Your little one is kept well stocked with all the oxygen he or she needs through the placenta. No breathing, deep or otherwise, needed. Some relief from that winded feeling usually arrives toward the end of the pregnancy when your baby drops into your pelvis in preparation for birth. In first pregnancies, this generally occurs 2 to 3 weeks before delivery. In subsequent deliveries, often not until labor starts. Until then, be sure to take it easy and slow down, decreasing the amount of work your lungs have to do. You may find it easier to breathe if you sit up straight instead of slumped over and sleep in a semi-propped position, bolstered by 2 or 3 pillows. When you're feeling especially breathless, lift your arms over your head to take pressure off your ribcage so you can breathe in more air. Try some breathing exercises as well. Breathe in slowly and deeply, making sure your ribcage, not your abdomen, is expanding. Put your hands on the sides of your ribcage and make sure the ribs push out against your hands as you inhale deeply. Breathe out slowly and deeply, feeling the contraction of your ribcage. Return to this type of deep breathing whenever you feel a little breathless. Sometimes breathlessness can be a sign of low iron stores, so check with your practitioner about it. Alert your practitioner if shortness of breath is accompanied by chest pain, a cough, and/or heart palpitations.
Choosing a pediatrician. Choosing a pediatrician or a family physician is one of the most important decisions you'll make as a parent. And actually, one you shouldn't wait until you become a parent to make. Sifting through your choices and making your selection now, before your baby starts crying inexplicably at 3 a.m., will ensure that your transition to parenthood is that much easier. It will also allow for an informed, not rushed, decision. If you're not sure where to begin your search, ask your practitioner for a referral. If you've been generally happy with the care you've been getting during pregnancy, or poll friends, neighbors, or coworkers who have young children for their favorite pediatricians. You can also look online for local pediatrician groups, though online listings of physicians are not always accurate, or local parent groups to ask for their recommendations. Or contact the hospital or birthing center where you'll be delivering. You can call the labor and delivery floor or pediatrics and ask a nurse on duty for some suggestions. No one gets a better look at doctors than nurses do. Of course, if you're on a health insurance plan that limits your choices, you'll have to pick from that list. Once you've narrowed your options to two or three, call for consultations. Most pediatricians or family physicians will oblige. Bring a list of questions about issues that are important to you, such as office protocol. For instance, whether there are call-in hours for parents or when you can expect calls to be returned. Breastfeeding support, circumcision, the use of antibiotics, whether the doctor handles all well baby visits, or if they're typically handled by nurse practitioners in the practice. Also important to know, is the doctor board certified? Which hospital is the doctor affiliated with, and will he or she be able to care for the newborn in the hospital? For more questions to ask and issues to consider, check out What to Expect the First Year.
Morning sickness again.
I've been feeling nauseous again recently, but I thought that was only a first trimester pregnancy symptom.
Feel like you've seen this movie before and aren't happy to see a sequel? While first trimester morning sickness definitely gets more attention and more expectant sufferers, for some mamas to be the third trimester variety can cause just as much misery, sometimes even more. Especially discouraging if you thought you'd seen the last of that nausea and vomiting, at least in this pregnancy. Remember those pregnancy hormones you blame for your first trimester morning sickness? You can blame them again, along with your ever-growing uterus, which has been crowding out your digestive tract, causing stomach acids to bubble back up the esophagus, leading to reflux and a return of nausea. With less space to hold your meals and no easy way to digest them, extra food often has nowhere to go other than up and out. Another case for grazing on mini meals. Braxton Hicks contractions can also unsettle your stomach, sometimes causing stomach cramps and even vomiting. Try combating this pregnancy queasiness with the tips for early pregnancy morning sickness and heartburn. And be sure to stay hydrated, especially if you've been vomiting. Dehydration is never safe when you're expecting, but it's especially unsafe in late pregnancies since dehydration can lead to preterm contractions. Mention your queasiness to your practitioner too. He or she might suggest antacids or anti-nausea meds if it's really bad. Your practitioner should also be able to rule out other, less likely reasons for this late onset nausea and vomiting, including preeclampsia and preterm labor. Lack of bladder control.
I watched a funny movie last night and noticed I was peeing myself a little every time I laughed. What is that about?
It's called stress incontinence, appropriately, since it can really stress a mama out. This sudden, often inconvenient, and embarrassing loss of bladder control, which can cause you to spring a small leak when you cough, sneeze, lift something heavy, or even laugh, though there's nothing funny about that, is the result of the mounting pressure of your growing uterus on your bladder. Some expectant moms also experience urge incontinence, the overwhelmingly, seemingly out-of-nowhere need to pee. Gotta go now, during late pregnancy. Try these tips to help prevent or control stress or urge incontinence. Empty your bladder as completely as possible by leaning forward each time you pee. Practice your Kegels. Being faithful to your Kegels will help prevent or correct most cases of pregnancy-induced incontinence. Plus, looking ahead, they'll also help prevent postpartum incontinence of both the urinary and fecal kind. Do Kegels or cross your legs when you feel a cough, sneeze, or laugh coming on, or the urge to pee coming on. Wear a panty liner if you need one or you're afraid you'll need one. Graduate to a maxi pad or bladder control pad when leaks might be especially inconvenient. Stay as regular as you can, because impacted stool can put pressure on the bladder. Also, straining hard when you're pooping can weaken pelvic floor muscles. If it's the urge that's driving you crazy and always sending you to the bathroom in a hurry, try training your bladder. Urinate more frequently, about every 30 minutes to an hour, so that you go before you feel that uncontrollable need. After a week, try to gradually stretch the time between bathroom visits, adding 15 minutes more at a time. Continue drinking enough fluids, even if you experience stress incontinence or frequent urges. Limiting your fluid intake will not limit leaks, and it may lead to a UTI and or dehydration. Not only can both of these lead to a lot of other problems, including preterm contractions, but UTIs can make stress and urge incontinence worse. To be sure the leak you've sprung is urine, which it almost certainly is, and not amniotic fluid, it's smart to give it the sniff test. If the liquid that is leaked doesn't smell like urine, urine smells ammonia-like, while amniotic fluid has a sweet smell, let your practitioner know as soon as possible. How you're carrying.
Everyone says I seem to be carrying small for the 8th month. My midwife says everything's fine, but is it possible my baby's not growing as fast as she should?
The truth is, you can't tell a baby by her mom's belly. How you're carrying has much less to do with the size of your baby and much more to do with these factors. Your own size, shape, and bone structure. Bumps come in all sizes, just like expected moms do. A petite mom may carry more compactly, small, low, and out in front, than a larger mom, or she may seem to be carrying larger in comparison to her slighter scale. A bigger bone mom may have less to show bump-wise, simply because there's more area for her uterus and her baby to spread out in. Same for some very obese women. With so much room in an already ample abdomen, these moms-to-be may never seem to pop at all. Your muscle tone. A mom-to-be with very tight muscles may not show as soon or as much as one whose muscles are slacker. For that reason, and because each baby tends to end up a little larger than the last, second and more time moms tend to end up a bit larger too. Your baby's position. How your fetus is positioned on the inside may also affect how big or small you look on the outside. Your weight gain. A bigger weight gain doesn't necessarily predict a bigger baby, just a bigger mom. If you've kept your weight gain within recommended guidelines, you may appear smaller because you're sporting less fat, not because you're carrying less baby. The only assessments of a baby size that are worth paying attention to are the ones you get from your practitioner, not the ones you get from your sister-in-law, your coworkers, social media buddies commenting on your bump selfies, or know-it-all nosy buddies in the supermarket checkout line. In other words, it's what's inside that counts. And apparently, what's inside your little bump is a baby who's plenty big enough.
Oh, my aching pelvic bones. Does your pelvis sometimes feel as if it's coming apart at the seams, with wrenching pain in the pubic area, or in the perineum or upper thighs, that makes walking agonizing and climbing stairs or getting in and out of the car excruciating? You may have what's called pelvic girdle pain, or symphysis pubis dysfunction, a surprisingly common and unexpectedly painful condition that affects up to 25% of moms-to-be, usually late in the last trimester, as ligaments that normally keep the pelvic bone aligned become over-relaxed and stretchy in preparation for labor. The gender guessing game. All belly and glowing skin, you're having a boy. Spreading hips, nose, and zits, it's a baby girl on board. If you've opted out of the gender reveal, you've probably generated plenty of predictions on your baby's sex based entirely on how you're carrying, how you're feeling, and how you're looking. Just remember that those predictions, by old wives or others, have about a 50% chance of coming true. Actually, a little better than that if a boy is predicted, since 105 boys are born for every 100 girls. In other words, keep them guessing.
Your size and your delivery.
I'm tiny, just 5 feet tall, and I'm wondering whether that'll make it harder for me to deliver vaginally.
Size matters when it comes to birthing your baby, but inside size, not outside size. It's the internal numbers, the size and shape of your pelvis in relationship to the size of your baby's head, that determine how difficult or easy your labor will be, not your height or your build. A petite mom can have a roomier or more accommodatingly configured pelvis than a plus-size mom, or she can have a baby with an easier-to-fit head. How will you know what size your pelvis is? After all, it doesn't come labeled. Your practitioner can make an educated guess about its size, usually using rough measurements taken at your first prenatal exam. Your baby size will be approximated too, as your due date approaches. If there's some concern that your baby's head is too large to fit through your pelvis, ultrasound may be used to get a better view and measurement. Of course, in general, the overall size of the pelvis, as all bony structures, is smaller in people of smaller stature. But that's the genius of genetics. Nature doesn't typically present a tiny mom with a giant offspring. Instead, babies are usually pretty well matched to mom's size and the size of her pelvis, even if they are destined for bigger things later on. And chances are your baby will be just the right size for you. Your weight gain and the baby size.
I've gained so much weight that I'm afraid my baby will be huge and hard to deliver.
Just because you've gained a lot of weight doesn't necessarily mean your baby has. Your baby's weight is determined by a number of variables. Genetics, your own birth weight. If you were born large, your baby is more likely to be too. Your pre-pregnancy weight, heavier women tend to have heavier babies, and the quality of your pregnancy diet. Depending on those variables, a 35 to 40-pound weight gain can yield a 6 or 7-pound baby, and a 25-pound weight gain can net an 8-pounder. On average, however, the more substantial the weight gain, the bigger the baby. Moms who have GD that isn't well controlled may also be more likely to have a very large baby. By palpating your abdomen and measuring the height of your fundus, the top of your uterus, your practitioner will be able to give you some idea of your baby's size, though such guesstimates can be off by a pound or more. An ultrasound can gauge size more accurately, but it may be off the mark too. Even if your baby does turn out to be on the big side, that doesn't automatically predict a difficult delivery. Though a 7-pound baby often makes its way out faster than a 10-pounder, most women are able to deliver a large baby, or even an extra-large baby, vaginally and without complications. The determining factor, as in any delivery, is whether your baby's head, the largest part, can fit through your pelvis. Baby's position.
How can I tell which way my baby is facing? I want to make sure he's the right way for delivery.
Playing name that bump, trying to figure out which are shoulders, elbows, bottom, may be endlessly entertaining, but it's not the most accurate way of figuring out your baby's position. Your practitioner will be able to give you a better idea by palpating your abdomen for recognizable baby parts. The location of the baby's heartbeat is another clue to its position. If the baby's presentation is head first, the heartbeat will usually be heard in the lower half of your abdomen, and it will be loudest if the baby's back is toward your front. If there's still some doubt, an ultrasound offers the most reliable view of baby's position. Still can't resist a round of your favorite evening pastime, or resist patting those round little parts? Play away, and to make the game more interesting and to help clue you in, try looking for these markers next time. Baby's back is usually a smooth, convex contour, opposite a bunch of little irregularities, which are the small parts, hands, feet, elbows. Sometime around the 8th month, baby's head usually settles near mom's pelvis. It is round, firm, and when pushed down, bounces back without the rest of the body moving. Baby's bottom is a less regular shape and softer than the head. Bottoms up, hopefully. Breech baby.
At my last prenatal visit, my doctor said he felt my baby's head up near my ribs. Does that mean she's breech?
Even as her accommodations become ever more cramped, your baby will still manage to perform some pretty remarkable gymnastics during the last weeks of her stay. In fact, although most fetuses settle into a head-down position between weeks 32 and 38, breech presentations occur in fewer than 5% of full-term pregnancies. Some don't let on which end will ultimately be up until a few days before birth, which means that just because your baby is bottoms down now doesn't mean she will be breech when it comes time for delivery.
If my baby is breech, can anything be done to turn him?
There are several ways to try to coax a bottoms down baby bottoms up. On the lower tech side, your practitioner may recommend simple exercises. Two other options come from the CAM camp. One is moxibustion, which uses a form of acupuncture and burning herbs to help turn a fetus, although studies show with a low success rate. The other is the Webster technique, as well as other chiropractic maneuvers. Clearly, it's important to use a CAM practitioner who is experienced and has had plenty of success using these therapies to turn breech babies, and to make sure your practitioner is on board with the therapy you're considering. If your baby seems determined not to budge, your practitioner may suggest a somewhat higher-tech, yet hands-on approach to manipulating your baby into the coveted heads-down position, external cephalic version, ECV. ECV is usually performed around weeks 36 to 38, or very early in labor, when the uterus is still relatively relaxed and before mom's membranes have ruptured. It's always done in a hospital in case an emergency C-section is needed, which happens rarely. Since an ample amount of amniotic fluid is necessary to help facilitate a safe ECV, levels are checked first via ultrasound. Ultrasound may also be used to guide the doctor during ECV, and baby's heart rate will be watched with an electronic fetal monitor to make sure he's doing well before and after the procedure. Medication may be given to prevent contractions, so the uterus stays relaxed, and you may also get an epidural, which not only prevents any pain, but also keeps the uterus relaxed, apparently boosting the odds of ECV success. Your practitioner will apply his or her hands to your abdomen, one near baby's head, one near baby's bottom. You'll feel some pressure and possibly some discomfort, though not if you've had an epidural, and try to gently turn your little one around. ECV is successful in nearly two-thirds of attempts. The success rate is even higher for those who've had an epidural, as well as those who have delivered before, thanks to those more lax uterine and abdominal muscles. But it's slightly lower for obese women, since abdominal padding can make maneuvering baby more challenging. The more experience a doctor has in turning babies, the better the success rate generally is. Some doctors have a rate as high as 90%. And happily, the complications rate is low across the board, less than 1% for serious complications that might lead to an emergency C-section. Some babies refuse to turn at all, though often a doctor will suggest multiple attempts, and a small number of contrary fetuses turn and then flip back into a breech position, in which case your doctor might also suggest trying again. Having multiples, you're most likely not a candidate for ECV. Ditto if you've had a prior C-section.
If my baby stays in a breech position, will I still be able to try for a vaginal birth?
Whether you'll be able to give vaginal birth a chance will depend on a variety of factors, including your practitioner's policy and your situation. Most OBs routinely perform a C-section when a baby refuses to budge out of a breech position, because many studies have suggested it's a safer way to go. There are some doctors and midwives, however, who feel it's reasonable to attempt a vaginal delivery in certain circumstances, especially if they're experienced delivering breech babies vaginally. The best case circumstance when a baby is in a frank breech position, buttocks first, with legs straight up and flat against his or her face. And it's clear that mom's pelvis is roomy enough to accommodate a vaginal delivery. The bottom line, if your baby remains bottom down, you'll need to be flexible in your childbirth plans. Even if your practitioner greenlights a trial of labor, it's just that, a trial. If your breech baby doesn't move down the birth canal, or if other problems come up, you'll likely wind up having a C-section. Talk the options over with your practitioner now so you'll be prepared for any possibility come delivery day.
Face forward. It's not just up or down that's important when it comes to your baby's position. It's also front or back. If baby's facing your back, chin tucked onto chest, as most babies end up, you're in luck. This so-called occiput anterior position is ideal for birth because your baby's head is lined up to fit through your pelvis as easily and comfortably as possible, smallest head part first. If baby's facing your tummy, called occiput posterior, but also known by the much cuter term sunny side up, it's a setback for back labor because his or her skull will be pressing on your spine. It also means your baby's exit might take a little longer. As delivery day approaches, your practitioner will try to determine which way, front or back, your baby's head is facing. But if you're in a hurry to find out, you can look for these clues. When your baby is in occiput anterior, face toward your back, your belly will feel hard and smooth. That's your baby's back. If your little one is posterior, your tummy may look flatter and softer because your baby's arms and legs are facing forward, so there's no hard, smooth back to feel. Do you think, or have you been told, that your baby is posterior? Don't worry about back labor yet. Most babies turn accommodatingly to the anterior position during labor. Some midwives recommend giving baby a nudge before labor begins by getting on all fours and doing pelvic rocks. Others suggest placing warm towels on mom's back and cold ones on her tummy because babies naturally turn away from cold. These tactics can also be tried during labor. Whether they can successfully flip a baby is unclear, but they can't hurt. And who knows, they could help relieve any back pain you have now.
Other unusual presentations.
My doctor said that my baby's in an oblique position. What's that, and what does it mean for delivery?
Babies can squirm their way into all kinds of unusual positions, and oblique is one of them. What this means is that your baby's head, though down, is pointed toward one of your hips, rather than squarely on your cervix. An oblique position makes a vaginal exit difficult, so your practitioner might do ECV or suggest other techniques to try to coax your baby's head straight down. If none of these work, even after multiple attempts, he or she will probably opt for a C-section. Yet another tight spot a baby can get into is a transverse position. This is when your baby's lying sideways, across your uterus, instead of vertically. Again, an ECV or other techniques will be done to try to turn baby up and down. If that doesn't work, your baby will be delivered by a cesarean.
Turn, baby, turn. Some practitioners recommend simple exercises to help turn a breech baby into a delivery-friendly, heads-down position. Though there isn't much medical evidence to prove they work, they're probably worth a shot. Ask your practitioner if you should be trying any of these baby-moving moves at home. Rock back and forth a few times on your hands and knees, several times a day, with your buttocks higher than your head. Forward-leaning inverse. Have someone help you with this position. Kneel on the edge of a couch and carefully lower yourself to your hands on the floor, and then lower yourself to your forearms, head propped on your arms or hanging freely. Take 3 breaths, then return to a kneeling position. Do this 3 or 4 times a day. Knee to chest position. If you're alone, with no one around to spot you for safety's sake, you can do a modified version of the forward-leaning inverse. Get on your knees, keep them slightly apart, and then bend over so your butt's up and your belly's almost touching the floor. Stay in that position for 20 minutes, 3 times a day if you can, for best results. Breech pelvic tilts. Lie on your back on a mat or carpeted surface, then lift your hips off the floor. Use your heels to push your lower body up, keeping your hands, arms, and shoulders flat on the floor. The idea is to get your hips above your head. Not feeling the pelvic tilt? For a simpler version, lie on your back and prop up your hips with pillows. Hot and cold. Put a cold pack or a bag of frozen vegetables on the top of your belly where your baby's head is, and place a warm compress on your lower belly, or submerge your lower half in a warm tub. Some say this will encourage baby to seek the warmth and move his or her head away from the cold sensation. Music to baby's ears. Playing soothing music or singing near mom's pelvis may coax a baby to flip for a better listen. Again, no proof it works, but certainly no harm trying. How does your baby lie? Location, location, location. When it comes to delivery, a baby's location matters a lot. Most babies present head first or in a vertex position. Breech presentations can come in many forms. A frank breech is when the baby is buttocks first, with his or her legs facing straight up and flat against the face. A footling breech is when one or both of the legs are pointing down. During labor, the first presenting part is baby's foot and leg. A transverse lie is when baby is lying sideways in the uterus. An oblique lie is when baby's head is pointing toward mom's hip instead of toward the cervix.
Cesarean delivery.
I was hoping for a vaginal birth, but my doctor just told me I'll probably have to have a C-section. I'm really disappointed.
Even though it's still considered major surgery and by far the happiest kind, a cesarean is a very safe way to deliver, and in some cases, the safest way. It's also a pretty common way, and in the view of many experts, too common. About 32% of women are having C-sections these days, which means the chances that your baby will end up arriving via the surgical route are just under 1 in 3, even if you don't have any predisposing factors. That said, if you had your heart set on a vaginal delivery, the news that your baby may need to arrive surgically instead can be understandably disappointing. Visions of pushing your baby out the way nature intended, and perhaps the way you'd always pictured, can be displaced by concerns about the surgery, about being stuck in the hospital longer, about the tougher recovery, and about the scar that comes standard issue. First, make sure you've had a discussion with your practitioner about why a cesarean delivery might be necessary in your case. Ask if there are potential options that can be tried, like attempting to turn your breech baby or doing a trial of labor to see how things progress. If ultimately your practitioner determines that your baby's safest exit strategy is through your abdomen, then consider the following. Most hospitals now strive to make a cesarean delivery as family-friendly as possible, with mom awake but appropriately numb, dad by her side, and a chance to meet, greet, cuddle, and possibly breastfeed baby right after delivery if there's no medical reason why not. In fact, a growing number of hospitals now offer, or may be open to facilitating, a gentle cesarean. In a gentle cesarean, noise is kept to a minimum, and clear drapes are set up so mom can watch as her baby emerges. An option in some hospitals, a drape with a built-in portal so baby can be handed directly to mom without compromising the sterile surgical environment. EKG electrodes are placed toward mom's back so there's room for baby to snuggle on her chest, and one arm is left free of cuffs, monitors, and IVs so she can hold her freshly delivered baby and even breastfeed. Cord clamping is delayed as it ideally is in a vaginal birth. Have a doula or a midwife who cared for you during your pregnancy, you may be able to invite him or her into the OR too. In other words, a surgical birth experience may be more satisfying and less disappointing than you're imagining. And while the recovery will be longer in hospital and out, and the scar unavoidable, though usually placed unobtrusively, you'll also be delivering with your perineum intact and your vaginal muscles unstretched. One more piece of good news, studies show that having a C-section doesn't negatively impact your future fertility or how many babies you can have. And there's an upside for baby that's purely cosmetic and temporary. Because there's no tight squeeze through the birth canal, he or she will have an initial edge in appearance over vaginally delivered babies. Think roundhead, not pointy. But by far the most important thing to keep in mind as your baby's arrival approaches, the best birth is the one that's safest, and when it's definitely medically necessary, a cesarean birth is definitely safest. And after all, any delivery that brings a healthy baby into the world and into your arms is a perfect delivery.
Why does it seem everyone is having C-sections these days?
There has actually been quite a push to lower the rate of cesarean deliveries in the U.S. Experts are encouraging more trials of labor to promote vaginal birth after prior cesarean deliveries, VBAC, and more widespread use of vacuum and forceps delivery to prevent unnecessary surgical deliveries. They're also suggesting that moms be given more time to labor and to push, and or that doctors use Pitocin as needed to nudge nature along, assuming all is going well, before they move on to a C-section. Finally, there's a growing recognition that while C-sections are very safe, there's still major surgery, which comes with greater risk, including that a mom will end up needing a repeat next time. In other words, experts agree C-sections shouldn't be the delivery of choice, at least when there is a choice. Still, while rates of C-section have declined about 2% over the last few years, and even a little more among low-risk moms, the numbers are still very high, and in the minds of many, including most doctors, too high. Why? There are a number of reasons. Bigger babies. With more expectant moms exceeding the recommended weight gain of 25 to 35 pounds, and with the rate of GD increasing, more large babies who may be more difficult to deliver vaginally are arriving. A wrinkle. Since estimates of a baby's birth weight based on ultrasound measurements can be unreliable, in about 20% of cases, estimates are high, a baby who's predicted to be too large to deliver vaginally may end up not so big after all. These overestimates sometimes result in unnecessary scheduled C-sections. Bigger moms. The C-section rate has also risen with the obesity rate. Being obese or gaining too much weight during pregnancy significantly increases a woman's chance of needing a C-section, partly because of other risk factors that accompany obesity, diabetes, for instance, or hypertension, partly because obese women tend to have longer labors, and longer labors are more likely to end up on the operating table. Older mothers. More and more women in their late 30s and well into their 40s are now able to have successful pregnancies, and though their rates of C-sections have been dropping, older moms are still more likely to require a surgical delivery. The same is true of women with chronic health problems. Multiples. More and more multiples are being born these days, and there's a higher chance of delivering via cesarean if you're birthing multiple babies, though a vaginal birth with twins is often possible. Repeat C-sections. Though VBAC is still considered a viable option in many cases, and though more and more experts are encouraging VBACs, fewer doctors and hospitals are allowing moms to try one, and more are scheduling surgeries instead of attempting a trial of labor. Fewer instrumental deliveries. Fewer babies are being born with the help of vacuum extraction, and even fewer with forceps. That's largely because training in these instrumental deliveries dropped off as C-section rates took off, so many doctors feel more comfortable going straight for the surgical option when they might have, back in the day, routinely tried an instrument-assisted birth first. This may change as OB training begins to reflect changing attitudes about these delivery options. Requests by moms. Since cesarean deliveries are safe and can prevent the pain of labor while keeping the perineum neatly intact, some women, particularly those who've had a C-section before, and actually ask ahead for one. These numbers are dropping, however, especially as many practitioners have begun discouraging medically unnecessary C-sections. That's because unnecessary C-sections come with unnecessary risks, while vaginal deliveries, when they're possible, are safer, especially for mom. Time limits in labor. Some doctors put time limits on how long labor should last, how long it should take for the cervix to dilate, for instance, or how long a mom should push. When artificial time limits are placed on the length of labor, doctors may proceed to a surgical delivery before giving the laboring mom and her baby a fair chance to progress. Happily, there are now strong efforts underway to change the recommendations on how long to let a mom labor and push before resorting to a C-section, assuming everything is still proceeding safely. And that's a push that may do a lot to help bring the rate of cesarean deliveries down. Another change that may push C-section rates down. Having moms stay at home a little longer. Moms who show up at the hospital very early in labor may be somewhat more likely to end up having a C-section. C-section rates are much lower for patients of midwives, not only because midwives attend only low-risk births, but because they tend to let moms take their time with labor and delivery, again, assuming all is well. But even with C-section rates as high as they are these days for doctor-attended births, keep in mind that surgical deliveries still comprise the minority of births. After all, 2 out of 3 women can expect to deliver their babies vaginally.
Reasons for a scheduled C. While some women won't find out whether they're having a C-section until they're well into labor, others will get the heads up ahead of time. joining the ranks of moms-to-be who are scheduled for a cesarean delivery. Though the following don't automatically mean you'll need a C-section, these are the most common reasons why one might be scheduled in advance. A previous C-section, when VBAC is not an option. When a fetus's head is estimated to be too large to fit through mom's pelvis, cephalopelvic disproportion. But since a baby's size can be overestimated, attempting a trial of labor may be possible first. Baby may fit more easily than believed. Higher order multiples, almost all triplets, quads, and more, and many twins, are delivered by C-section. Breech or other unusual presentation. Studies show that a cesarean delivery is usually safest when efforts to turn a breech baby haven't succeeded. Many midwives and some doctors may attempt a vaginal breech birth in some circumstances. A condition in mom or baby that may make labor and vaginal delivery risky. Obesity in mom. Obesity increases the odds of a C-section for several reasons. For one, obese moms tend to have ineffective contractions in early labor, which means they don't make progress as quickly. For another, extra abdominal padding makes it harder to monitor a baby during a vaginal delivery. Another factor, both ECV, to turn a breech baby to a vaginal delivery-friendly position, and VBAC are less successful in obese moms than in average weight moms. And finally, obese moms often have larger-than-average babies, making cesarean deliveries a safer bet in many, but not all, cases. An active herpes infection, especially a primary one, or poorly controlled HIV infection that can be transmitted to the baby during a vaginal delivery. Placenta previa, when the placenta partially or completely blocks the cervical opening, or placental abruption, when the placenta separates from the uterine wall too soon. If your practitioner says you'll need a scheduled C-section, ask for a detailed explanation of the reason or reasons why. Ask, too, if any alternatives, such as a trial of labor, are open to you. C-section decision during labor. Often the decision to perform a C-section is made only once labor is well underway, and it's usually to ensure the safety of the mom and her baby. Sometimes it's because labor fails to progress. The cervix isn't dilating, even after attempts have been made to give sluggish contractions a boost with oxytocin, or it's taking too long to push the baby out, and delivery with vacuum extractor or forceps has failed or isn't appropriate. Sometimes it's because there's fetal distress. The baby's heart rate has plummeted to a dangerously low level, or because the uterus has ruptured, or because of a prolapsed umbilical cord, when the cord slips out the birth canal before the baby does, running the risk of being compressed and depriving the baby of oxygen. As always, the safety of both mom and baby will be the prime consideration in whether to turn to a surgical delivery.
For dads, prepping for a C-section. Wondering if your partner's scheduled C-section means your coaching days are over, even before they started? No, not at all. While you won't be able to pitch in quite as actively during a surgical delivery as you would during a vaginal birth, your coaching will still be more valuable than you might think. A dad's reaction at a cesarean delivery can actually have an impact on mom's level of anxiety. Meaning a less stressed father contributes greatly to a less stressed mother. And there's no better way to reduce your stress than knowing what to expect. So sign up together for a childbirth education class that includes C-sections in the curriculum. Read up on surgical deliveries and recoveries, and get as prepped as you can. Be prepared to help her through breathing and relaxing techniques so she stays calm during the C-section. And remember that you'll be by her side to support her as you both welcome your baby into this world. Any kind of surgery can seem like a scary proposition, but C-sections are extremely safe for both mom and baby. Plus, most hospitals now strive to make them as family-friendly as possible, allowing you to watch if you want to. Either by lowering the drape or using a clear drape, sit by your spouse's side, hold her hand, which in most hospitals will not be strapped down, and hold and cuddle the baby right after birth, just like the couples delivering vaginally down the hall. If the hospital where you'll be delivering doesn't officially offer a gentle cesarean policy, it definitely doesn't hurt to ask the doctor and hospital staff whether some or all of the measures can be applied at your baby's birth.
Repeat cesareans.
I've had 2 C-sections and want to go for my 3rd and maybe my 4th. Is there a limit on how many C-sections you can have?
Thinking of having lots of babies, but not sure whether you'll be allowed to make multiple trips to the hospital's happiest operating room? Chances are you'll be able to. There are no arbitrary limits placed on the number of cesarean deliveries a woman can undergo, and having numerous C-sections is generally considered a safe option. Just how safe depends on the type of incision made during the previous surgeries, as well as on the scars that form after the procedures. So discuss the particulars of your case with your OB. Depending on how many incisions you've had, where you've had them, and how they've healed, multiple C-sections can put you at a higher risk for certain complications. These include uterine rupture, placenta previa, a low-lying placenta, and placenta accreta, an abnormally attached placenta. So you'll need to be especially alert for any bright red bleeding during your pregnancies, as well as the signs of oncoming labor, contractions, bloody show, your water breaking. If any of these occur, notify your practitioner right away.
Scheduled classes for scheduled Cs. Think a scheduled C-section means you won't have to schedule childbirth classes, or that you should drop out of the ones you signed up for? Not so fast. Childbirth education classes still have plenty to offer you and your partner, including plenty on what to expect during a C-section and with an epidural. Most classes also offer invaluable advice on taking care of your newborn, which you'll have to master no matter which exit your baby takes, breastfeeding, and possibly getting back into shape postpartum. And don't tune out when the teacher's going over the labor breathing routine with the other couples. You might find those skills come in handy when you're trying to stay relaxed in the OR, or after delivery, when you're confronted with both post-op pain and assorted postpartum aches.
Vaginal birth after cesarean. Feedback.
I had a cesarean delivery with my first baby. Should I try for a vaginal delivery now that I'm expecting baby number 2?
If you ask the experts, the answer to your question would probably be yes. In fact, ACOG guidelines say that attempting a VBAC is both a safe and appropriate choice for most women who had a prior cesarean delivery, or even 2 in some cases. Research shows that the very low risk of uterine rupture, less than 1%, is only elevated during VBAC under certain, less common circumstances. What's more, VBAC attempts are successful a full 60 to 80% of the time, meaning that a mom who tries VBAC is just as likely to end up with a vaginal delivery as a mom who never had a C-section. Yet, with all the mounting evidence and all the experts backing up VBAC, some doctors and hospitals won't even consider a vaginal delivery for a mom who has already had a C-section. More than 90% of women eligible for trying VBAC end up having a scheduled cesarean delivery instead. Why are VBAC rates so low? The answer lies more in hospital policies and high malpractice insurance rates than in the safety of VBAC. Some hospitals have even stopped offering VBACs because of safety and liability concerns and a shortage of staff and resources to handle emergencies. That said, there are still plenty of hospitals and doctors, some birthing centers, and many midwives who are open to and enthusiastically encourage VBACs. So your first step if you do decide you'd like to attempt a VBAC is to find a practitioner who is open to it. And then, taking into account the many factors that are predictive of a successful VBAC, you and your practitioner can decide whether it's the best choice in your case. Here are a few of those factors. VBAC is more likely to succeed if labor starts spontaneously. Doctors will often allow a VBAC attempt if labor has to be induced, but the rates of success are slightly lower in these cases. VBAC is recommended only if you have a low transverse uterine scar, and there's over a 90% chance that you do. Vertical uterine incisions, which are more likely to result in a uterine rupture and usually take VBAC off the table, are rarely used. VBAC is more likely to succeed if the reason for your last C-section no longer exists. For instance, if you had a C-section because of something unique to your previous pregnancy that isn't affecting your current pregnancy, maybe your baby was breached last time but is heads down this time, then a successful VBAC becomes more likely. On the other hand, if you needed a C-section because the size or shape of your pelvis led to an especially slow or stalled labor the first time around, you may encounter the same problem the next time you try to deliver vaginally, making the chances of successful VBAC lower. VBAC is more likely to succeed if you start out pregnancy at a healthy weight and if you kept your pregnancy weight gain on target. Research shows that VBAC success is 40% lower among women who gained more than 40 pounds during pregnancy compared to women who gained less than that. Overweight and obese women who attempt VBAC are also less likely to successfully deliver vaginally in general, even after accounting for baby's larger size. A large baby is more common in overweight women. VBAC is more likely to succeed if your baby is average size. Research shows that the chance of VBAC failure is 50% higher when babies weigh more than 8 pounds, 13 ounces at delivery, compared to babies weighing less than 7 pounds, 11 ounces. A large baby may also increase the risk of uterine rupture and perineal tears, which is one reason why some doctors won't perform a VBAC on a mom who's more than a week past her due date. Older babies may be larger babies. Second and subsequent babies are, on average, larger than first babies. Still, having a too large to fit baby before doesn't mean you'll definitely have one this time. VBAC can be an excellent choice if you've had a vaginal birth before. Research suggests that if you've already delivered a baby vaginally before having one or more by C-section, your likelihood of having a safe and successful VBAC is greater than 90%. If despite best efforts, you end up having a repeat C-section instead of a VBAC, try not to be disappointed. Remember that even a mom who never had a cesarean delivery before has a nearly 1 in 3 chance of having one. No regrets either if you decide ahead of delivery in consultation with your practitioner that you'd rather schedule an elective repeat C-section than attempt VBAC. Again, what's best for your baby and best for you is what matters.
My OB is encouraging me to try for a VBAC, but I'm not sure why I should bother going through labor when I might end up needing a C-section anyway.
Your feelings definitely factor into the decision of whether or not to give VBAC a chance. Still, your OB has a point. The risks of VBAC are very low, while C-section, after all, is still major surgery. A vaginal birth means a shorter hospital stay, a lower risk of infection, and a faster recovery. All good reasons to consider VBAC. What's more, if you are hoping to get an epidural during labor, you still can, even if a VBAC is in the works. There are even perks for baby if you give labor a try. The best strategy, weigh the pros and cons of VBAC, factor in your feelings, and then make the decision that feels right for you, whether it's to give labor a try or head straight for the OR, without regret.
Elective cesareans. Considering a scheduled cesarean that's not medically necessary or opting out of a trial of labor, here's something to consider first. The best time for your baby to arrive is when he or she is ready. When an elective delivery is planned, there's the possibility that baby will inadvertently be born too soon, particularly if the dates are off to begin with. Another potential perk for your baby, if you elect to let labor take its course, or try VBAC instead of scheduling a repeat cesarean delivery. There's evidence to suggest that babies who have gone through at least some labor have fewer health problems than those who never did, even if mom ultimately ends up with a medically necessary C-section.
Group B strep.
My doctor is going to test me for group B strep infection. What does that mean?
It means that your doctor is playing it safe. And when it comes to group B strep, safe is a very good way to play it. Group B strep, GBS, is a strain of bacteria that lives quietly in the vaginas of between 10 and 35% of healthy women, which makes them carriers of GBS, or GBS positive. That's no problem for them, since being GBS positive doesn't cause symptoms of any kind, and it isn't related to Group A strep, the kind that causes throat infections, but it can be a problem for their babies. That's because a baby who picks up GBS when exiting a mom's vagina is at risk of developing a serious infection. About one in every 200 babies born to GBS-positive mothers will. And that's why expectant moms are routinely tested for GBS, usually between 35 and 37 weeks. Testing before 35 weeks isn't accurate in predicting who will be carrying GBS at the time of delivery. Some hospitals and birthing centers offer a rapid GBS test that can screen women during labor and provide results within the hour, taking the place of the screen routinely done between weeks 35 and 37. Ask your practitioner if that's an option at the facility where you'll be delivering. How's the test done? It's performed using vaginal and rectal swabs. If you test positive, meaning you're a carrier, you'll be given IV antibiotics during labor. And this treatment virtually eliminates any risk to your baby. GBS can also show up in a urine culture obtained at a prenatal checkup. If it does, it'll be treated right away with oral antibiotics and again in labor with IV antibiotics. If your practitioner doesn't offer the GBS test during late pregnancy, you should request it. Even if you weren't tested, but end up in labor with certain risk factors that point to GBS, like preterm labor, a fever during labor, or water breaking more than 18 hours before delivery, your practitioner will just treat you with IV antibiotics to be sure you don't pass any infection you might have onto your baby. If you've previously delivered a baby with GBS, your practitioner may also skip the test and proceed straight to treatment during labor. Playing it safe through testing and, if necessary, treatment means that your baby will be protected from a GBS infection, and that's a very good thing.
Life-saving screenings for newborns. Most babies are born healthy and stay that way, but a very small percentage of infants are born apparently healthy and then suddenly sicken due to a metabolic disorder. Though most of these conditions are very rare, they can be life-threatening if they go undetected and untreated. Testing for these and other metabolic disorders is inexpensive, and in the very unlikely event that your baby tests positive for any of them, the pediatrician can verify the results and begin treatment immediately, which can make a tremendous difference in the prognosis. Luckily, there are ways to screen for such metabolic disorders. Drops of blood, taken routinely from an infant's heel after birth, are used to test for 21 or more serious genetic, metabolic, hormonal, and functional disorders, including PKU, hypothyroidism, congenital adrenal hyperplasia, biotinidase deficiency, maple syrup urine disease, galactosemia, homocystinuria, medium chain acyl-CoA dehydrogenase deficiency, and sickle cell anemia. All 50 states and the District of Columbia require newborn screenings for at least 21 disorders, and more than half of all states screen newborns for all 29 disorders for which the American College of Medical Genetics, ACMG, recommends testing. Check with your practitioner or your local board of health to find out what tests are done in your state. You can also look up your state's requirements at the National Newborn Screening and Genetics Resource Center's NNSGRC website, genes-r-us.uthscsa.edu. If your hospital doesn't automatically provide all 29 tests, you can arrange to have them done. For more information about newborn screening, check with the March of Dimes, marchofdimes.com. The CDC also recommends, and some states require, screening tests soon after birth for congenital heart disease, CHD. This condition, which affects 1 in 100 babies, can lead to disability or death if not caught and treated early. Happily, when a baby gets a diagnosis early and is treated early, those risks are reduced significantly, and in most cases, completely. Screening for CHD is simple and painless. A sensor is placed on your baby's skin to measure your little one's pulse and the amount of oxygen in his or her blood. If the results of the screening test seem questionable, the doctor will be able to do further testing, echocardiogram, an ultrasound of the heart, for instance, to determine if anything is wrong. If your state doesn't require the test, ask the pediatrician if it could be given to your baby anyway.
Taking baths now.
Is it okay for me to take a bath this late in pregnancy?
Run that tub and carefully hop or hoist yourself in. A warm bath is not only safe in late pregnancy, but can be just the ticket for soaking away those aches and pains and stresses after a long day. And what day isn't long when you're 8 months pregnant? If you're worried about bathwater entering your vagina, you may have heard that one through the pregnancy grapevine, don't be. Unless it's forced, as with douching, something you shouldn't be doing anyway, water can't get where it shouldn't go. And even if a little water does make its way up, the cervical mucus plug that seals the entrance to the uterus effectively protects its precious contents from an invasion of infectious organisms, should there be any floating around in your tub. Even once you're in labor and the mucus plug is dislodged, you can still spend time in the bath. In fact, hydrotherapy during labor can provide welcome pain relief. You can even opt to give birth in a tub. One caveat when you're tubbing for two, especially this late in the pregnancy game, make sure the tub has a non-slip surface or mat on the bottom so you don't take a tumble. And easy does it getting in and out. And as always, avoid irritating bubble baths. Driving now.
I can barely fit behind the wheel. Should I still be driving?
You can stay in the driver's seat as long as you fit there. And if it becomes too tight a squeeze, moving the seat back and tilting the wheel up should help. Assuming you've got the room and you're feeling up to it and aren't too distracted, driving short distances is fine up until delivery day. Car trips lasting more than an hour, however, may be hard to sit through late in pregnancy and can restrict circulation, no matter who's driving. If you must drive a longer distance, be sure to shift around in your seat frequently and stop every hour to get up and walk around. Doing some neck and back stretches may also keep you more comfortable. Don't, however, try to drive yourself to the hospital while in labor. A really strong contraction might prove dangerous on the road. And don't forget the most important road rule on any car trip, whether you are a driver or passenger. And even if you're a passenger being driven to the hospital or birthing center in labor, buckle up.
Popping placenta. Animals do it. Tribal women do it. Chinese medicine has advocated for it for hundreds of years. And now it seems half of Hollywood is doing it, along with plenty of other American moms. Eating your placenta after giving birth, called placentophagy, may not sound particularly appetizing, but it's an option more moms are putting in their birth plans, and maybe you're wondering whether you should order it up too. The placenta, the incredible organ that nourished and nurtured your baby during his or her 9-month stay in your uterine home, is usually just discarded after delivery. But proponents of placentophagy say that tossing your placenta is a waste, that consuming it instead can raise your energy levels, ward off anemia, give your milk supply a boost, balance hormones, and lower your chances of postpartum depression. Not game to gobble up your placenta, say, in a smoothie? Not to worry. Few new moms do. The most common way to eat your placenta, and undoubtedly the easiest to swallow, is in pill form. In a process called placenta encapsulation, your placenta is dried, powdered, and sealed into vitamin-sized capsules. There are companies who will do it for you, but it comes at a price. Some moms opt to do it themselves at home for free. DIY kits or instructions are available online. The placenta can also be distilled into an alcohol-based solution for you to take in drop form in your smoothies or other drinks. There are no clinical trials or scientific research to back the effectiveness of these placenta preparations, and most medical experts are skeptical about the perks of eating the afterbirth. They point out that the touted benefits may be the result of a placebo effect. If you expect to feel good after eating your placenta, you'll probably feel that way. And also point to women who end up sick after they've popped placenta pills or snacked on placenta. Another major potential downside to downing placenta, according to experts, there's the very real possibility of spreading infection when you're handling a raw, blood-filled organ easily contaminated by bacteria. a possibly better use of your placenta, storing its blood and cells. If you're considering using your placenta after delivery, be sure to find out if the hospital or birthing center you're delivering in will allow you to pack it up and take it home, or send it off for processing. Not all will. Of course, you won't have to contend with hospital protocols if you're delivering at home.
Traveling now.
I may have to travel for business this month. Is it safe this late in pregnancy, or should I cancel?
Before you schedule your trip, schedule a call or visit to your practitioner. Different practitioners have different points of view on last trimester travel, whether yours will encourage you or discourage you from hitting the road or the rails or the sky at this point in your pregnancy will probably depend on that point of view as well as on several other factors. Most important is the kind of pregnancy you've been having. You're more likely to get the green light if yours has been uncomplicated. How far along you are, most practitioners advise against flying after the 36th week, and most airlines won't allow it, and whether you are at any risk at all for premature labor will weigh into the recommendation too. Also very important is how you've been feeling. Pregnancy symptoms that multiply as the months pass also tend to multiply as the miles pass, and traveling can lead to increased backache, aggravate varicose veins and hemorrhoids, if you'll be sitting in a cramped airplane seat, and restrict circulation, increasing the risk of a blood clot. Other considerations include how far and for how long you'll be traveling and how long you will actually be in transit, how physically demanding the trip will be, and how necessary the trip is. Optional trips or trips that can be easily postponed may not be worth making now. If you're traveling by air, you'll also need to factor in any restrictions of the airline you choose. Some will not let you travel in the last month or two without a letter from your practitioner stating that you're not going into labor imminently, as in during the flight. Others offer more wiggle room, if not seat or leg room. And some may practice an unofficial don't ask, don't tell policy. After all, it's hard to judge how pregnant a woman is just from a glance at the check-in desk. If your practitioner gives you the go-ahead, there are still plenty of other arrangements you'll need to make besides the travel ones. Refer back to the tips on how to ensure happy and safer and more comfortable travels for the pregnant you. Getting plenty of rest and staying well hydrated will be especially key, but most important on your to-do list will be making sure you have the name, phone number, and address of a recommended practitioner and the hospital or birthing center where he or she delivers at your destination. One, of course, whose services will be covered by your insurance plan should you end up requiring them. If you're traveling a long distance, you may also want to consider the possibility of bringing along your partner on the remote chance that if you do end up going into labor at your destination, at least you won't have to deliver without him. And you might want to look into travel insurance just in case an unexpected complication forces you to cancel your trip. Sex now.
I hear a lot of conflicting opinions on whether sex in the last weeks of pregnancy is safe and whether it triggers labor.
Still have the get up and go you need to get it on? Then get up and go for it. The research that's been done both by scientists and by those playing doctor at home indicates that sex and orgasm for one or both partners doesn't trigger labor unless conditions for labor are ripe. That is, the cervix is ready for action. Then it's theorized the prostaglandins in sperm, like the prostaglandins sometimes used to help induce labor, and perhaps the oxytocin released with orgasm, might be able to help get the labor party started. But even then, under the right and ripest circumstances, you can't bank on sex taking you to the birthing room, as many overdue do-it-yourselfers have discovered. In fact, one study found that low-risk women who had sex in the final weeks of pregnancy carried their babies slightly longer than those who skipped sex during that time. Bottom line and going for your bottom lines. Based on what's known, most OBs and midwives allow patients with normal pregnancies to make love right up until delivery day. Check with your practitioner to see what's safe in your situation. If you get a green light, chances are you will, then by all means hit the sheets if you have the will and the energy and the gymnastic skills that might be necessary at this point. If the light is red in your case, and it probably will be if you are at high risk for premature labor, have placenta previa, or are experiencing unexplained bleeding, or if you're just not in the mood for lovemaking, try getting intimate in other ways. While you still have some evenings to yourselves, rendezvous for a romantic candlelit dinner or a moonlit stroll. Cuddle while you watch TV, or soap each other in the shower, or use massage as the medium. Or do everything but what's on your no-fly list, get a list of restrictions from your practitioner. This may not quite satisfy like the real thing, but try to remember that you have a whole lifetime of lovemaking ahead. Though the pickings may continue to be slim in that department, at least until baby's sleeping through the night.
Preparing for the unexpected. Birth plan? Done. Childbirth education classes? Doing. Disaster readiness? Say what? In all your pre-baby prep, you probably haven't given much thought to disaster preparedness, but experts say every expectant mom should. Disasters, whether natural or human-made, are fortunately uncommon, but they almost always strike unexpectedly. With a little bit of advanced planning, you and your baby-to-be can weather the storm, perhaps literally, of any disaster. Some things to think about. Have a communication plan. Landlines can go out and wireless networks can become overloaded during a disaster, making it impossible to reach your partner and other family by phone. Plan ahead to text and use social networks and messaging apps you share with family to get in touch during and after a disaster. Have a plan for medical emergencies and emergency delivery. Talk to your practitioner now about emergency options in case you go into labor or are having bleeding or other symptoms of a complication when phone lines are down, the practitioner's office isn't open, or you can't get to the hospital. And be sure you have a copy of your electronic health record handy in case you find yourself with an unfamiliar care provider in an emergency. Prepare an emergency kit and bag. Experts recommend having an emergency kit with at least 3 days' worth of non-perishable food on hand. Think nuts, freeze-dried fruit, whole grain crackers, peanut butter, granola bars, and canned goods with pull tabs. Water, at least 1 gallon per person or pet for 3 days. Prenatal vitamins, prescription medication, external cell phone batteries, a battery-operated radio, a blanket, a first aid kit, flashlight, extra batteries, hand sanitizer, and other things you may need. Have an emergency kit in your car, too. Visit ready.gov for more tips. Remember, too, how important it will be to take care of your baby and yourself during a disaster. To eat regularly, stay hydrated, and get the rest you need, as hard as those might be to do in such a stressful situation. And speaking of stress, try to make sure it doesn't overwhelm you, especially since extreme stress is sometimes linked to preterm labor. Tap into the relaxation techniques you're using to stay calm during pregnancy. And if you're not using them already, prepping for a just-in-case is another good reason to start. Some numbers to keep handy if disaster does strike and outside help is reachable. The National Disaster Distress Helpline, 1-800-985-5990. Or text TALK WITH US to 66746. You can also contact your local American Red Cross chapter or public health department for more information and help.
Year twosome.
The baby isn't even born yet, and already our relationship has changed. We're both so wrapped up in the birth and the baby instead of in each other.
Little babies bring big changes when they arrive, and often even before they arrive. Not surprisingly, your relationship with your partner is one place you'll notice that change, and it sounds like you've glimpsed it already. And that's actually a really good thing. When baby makes three, your twosome is bound to undergo some shifting of dynamics and reshuffling of priorities. But this predictable upheaval is usually less stressful and easier to adapt to when a couple begins the natural and inevitable evolution of their relationship during pregnancy. In other words, the changes to your relationship are more likely to represent a change for the better if they begin before baby's arrival. Couples who don't anticipate at least some disruption of romance as usual who don't realize that wine and roses will often give way to spit up and string carrots, that lovemaking marathons will place well behind baby-rocking marathons, that a party of three is not always as cozy as a party of two, at least not in the same way, often find the reality of life with a demanding newborn harder to handle. So think ahead, plan ahead, and be ready for change. But as you get yourselves into nurture mode, don't forget that baby won't be the only one who will need nurturing. As normal and healthy as it is to be wrapped up in your expected extra special delivery, it's also important to reserve some emotional energy for the relationship that created that bundle of joy in the first place. Now is the time to learn to combine the care and feeding of your baby with the care and feeding of your twosome. While you're busily feathering your nest, make the effort to regularly reinforce romance. Hug early and often each day. Hold hands while you're browsing for last-minute baby gear. Grab his butt or a kiss or a nuzzle for no reason at all. Cuddle in bed, reminiscing about your first date or dreaming about a second honeymoon, even if it won't be in the cards for many moons. Bring massage oil to bed now and then. Even if you're not in the mood for sex or it's seeming too much like hard work these days, any kind of touching can keep you close while reminding you both that there's more to life than Lamaze and layettes. Keeping this very important thought in mind now will make it easier to keep the love light burning later when you're taking turns walking the floor at 2 a.m. And that love light, after all, is what will make the cozy nest you're busily preparing for your baby a happy and secure one.
All about breastfeeding.
If you've given any thought at all to what's going on behind those giant bra cups you've likely traded up for over the last 8 months or so, chances are it's pretty clear. Your breasts are already on board with breastfeeding. Whether the rest of you is signed up too, or whether you're still weighing your baby feeding options, you'll probably want to learn more about this amazing process, a process that turns breasts, your breasts, into the perfect purveyors of the world's most perfect infant food. You'll get some valuable highlights and insights here, but for much more on breastfeeding, from the why-tos to the how-tos, see what to expect the first year. Here are the highlights. Why breast is best. Just as goat's milk is the ideal food for kids, goat kids that is, and cow's milk is the best meal for just born calves, your human breast milk is the perfect meal for your human newborn. Here are the reasons why. It's custom made. Tailored to meet the nutritional needs of human infants, breast milk contains at least 100 ingredients that aren't found in cow's milk and that can't be precisely replicated in commercial formulas. And unlike formula, the composition of breast milk changes constantly to meet a baby's ever-changing needs. It's different in the morning than it is in the late afternoon, different at the beginning of a feeding than at the end, different the first month than the seventh, and different for a preemie than for a full-term newborn. It even tastes different depending on what you've been snacking on, like your amniotic fluid does when you're pregnant. A one-of-a-kind food for your one-of-a-kind baby. It's easy to digest. Breast milk is designed for a new baby's brand new digestive system. The protein and fat in breast milk are easier to digest than those in formula, and its important micronutrients are more easily absorbed. It's a tummy soother. Breastfed babies are almost never constipated, thanks to the easier digestibility of breast milk. They also rarely have diarrhea, since breast milk appears to reduce the risk of digestive upset, both by destroying harmful microorganisms and by encouraging the growth of beneficial ones. You know the much-touted pre- and probiotics that are added to some formulas? They're naturally occurring in breast milk. It doesn't make a stink. On a purely aesthetic note, the poops of a breastfed baby are sweeter smelling, at least until solids are introduced. It's an infection preventer. With each and every feeding, nursers get a healthy dose of antibodies to boost their immunity to bugs of all varieties, which is why breastfeeding is sometimes referred to as a baby's first immunization. In general, breastfed babies come down with fewer colds, ear infections, lower respiratory tract infections, urinary tract infections, and other illnesses than formula-fed infants. And when they do get sick, they'll usually recover more quickly and with fewer complications. Breastfeeding also improves the immune response to vaccines for most diseases, such as tetanus, diphtheria, and polio. Plus, it may offer some protection against sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS. It's a fat flattener. Breastfed babies are less likely to be too chubby. That is in part because breastfeeding lets babies' appetite call the shots and the ounces. A breastfed baby is likely to stop feeding when full, while a bottle-feeding infant may be urged to keep feeding until the bottle's emptied. What's more, breast milk is actually ingeniously calorie-controlled. The lower calorie for milk served up at the start of a feed is designed as a thirst quencher. The higher calorie hind milk served up at the end of a feed is a filler-upper, signaling to a nurser that it's quitting time. And research suggests that the fat-defeating benefits of breastfeeding follow a baby out of the nursery and into high school. Studies show that former breastfeeders are less likely to battle weight as teens, and the longer they were breastfed, the lower their risk of becoming overweight. Another potential long-term health plus for nursers, breastfeeding is linked to lower cholesterol levels and lower blood pressure later in life. It keeps allergies on hold. Babies are almost never truly allergic to breast milk, though occasionally an infant may be sensitive to something mom has eaten. The formula flip side, more than 10% of babies turn out to be allergic to cow's milk formula. A switch to soy or hydrolysate formula usually solves the problem, but isn't ideal since those stray even further in composition from the gold standard formula, breast milk. And there's more good news on the allergy front. Evidence that breastfed babies may be less likely to develop asthma and eczema. It's a brain booster. Breastfeeding, according to some evidence, may slightly increase a child's IQ in early childhood. This may be related not only to the brain-building fatty acids, DHA, in breast milk, but also to the closeness and mother-baby interaction that is built into breastfeeding, which is believed to nurture a newborn's intellectual development. It's safe. You can be sure that the milk served up from your breasts is always perfectly prepared and never spoiled, contaminated, expired, or recalled. It's made for suckers. It takes longer to drain a breast than a bottle, giving newborns more of the comforting sucking satisfaction they crave. Plus, a breastfed baby can continue to comfort suck on a nearly empty breast, something an empty bottle doesn't allow. It builds stronger mouths. Mama's nipples and baby's mouth are made for each other, a naturally perfect match. Even the most scientifically designed bottle nipple can't match up to a breast nipple, which gives a baby's jaws, gums, teeth, and palate the ultimate workout, a workout that ensures optimum oral development and some perks for baby's future teeth, like better alignment. Another mouth perk to breastfeeding, babies who are breastfed are less likely to get cavities later on. It expands the taste buds early on. Want to raise an adventurous eater? Start at the breast. Developing those little taste buds on breast milk, which takes on the flavor of whatever you've been eating, may acclimate a baby early on to a world of flavors. Researchers have found that nurse babies are less likely to be timid in their tastes than their formula-fed peers once they graduate to the high chair, which means they may be more likely to open wide to that spoonful of yams or that forkful of curry chicken later on. Breastfeeding offers a pile of perks for mom and dad, too. Convenience. Breast milk is the ultimate convenience food, always in stock, ready to serve, and consistently dispensed at the perfect temperature. It's fast food, too. No formula to run out of, shop for, or lug around. No bottles to clean or refill. No powders to mix. No meals to warm, say when you're on a conference call and baby's wailing in the background. Wherever you are, in bed, on the road, at the mall, on the beach, all the nourishment your baby needs is always on tap. No muss or mess, no fuss. And if you and your baby aren't in the same place at the same time, you're at work, in school, at dinner, or even away for the weekend, a stash of Express breast milk can be served up in bottles. Money in the bank. The best things in life are free, and that includes breast milk and breast milk delivery. Open baby's mouth, insert mommy's breast. On the other hand, bottle feeding, once you factor in formula, bottles, nipples, cleaning supplies, can be a pretty pricey proposition. There's no waste with breastfeeding either. What baby doesn't end up drinking at one feed will stay fresh for the next. And because breastfed babies are generally healthier babies, you're likely to save money on healthcare costs and lost wages too, since you'll be less likely to miss work because of a sick baby. Speedier postpartum recovery. It's only natural that breastfeeding is best for newly delivered moms too. After all, it's the natural conclusion to the pregnancy-childbirth cycle. It'll help your uterus shrink back to pre-pregnancy size more quickly, which in turn will reduce your flow of lochia, the postpartum bloody discharge, decreasing blood loss. And by burning upward of 500 extra calories a day, breastfeeding can help you shed leftover pregnancy pounds faster. Some of those pounds were laid down as fat reserves, earmarked specifically for milk production. Now's your chance to use them. Some protection against pregnancy. It's far from a sure bet, but breastfeeding your baby may suppress ovulation and your period for several months. Is this a birth control bet you should take without a backup? Probably not, unless back-to-back pregnancies are your objective. Health benefits for mom. Plenty of perks here. Women who breastfeed have a slightly lower risk of developing uterine cancer, ovarian cancer, and premenopausal breast cancer. They're also less likely to develop type 2 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and osteoporosis than women who don't breastfeed. Another benefit for breastfeeding moms. Research suggests that women who breastfeed are somewhat less likely to suffer from postpartum depression, though PPD can strike a breastfeeding mom and can also strike a mom after she weans, as hormones fluctuate once again. Nighttime feeds that are a relative breeze. Have a hungry baby at 2 a.m.? You will. And when you do, you'll appreciate how fast you'll be able to feed that baby if you're breastfeeding. No stumbling to the kitchen to prepare a bottle in the dark. Just pop a warm breast into that warm little mouth. Eventually, easy multitasking. Sure, nursing your newborn will take both arms and a lot of focus at first. But once you and baby become nursing pros, you'll be able to do just about anything else at the same time, from eating dinner to playing with your toddler. Built-in bonding. The benefit of breastfeeding you're likely to appreciate most is the bond it nurtures between you and your little one. There's skin-to-skin and eye-to-eye contact and the opportunity to cuddle and coo built right into every feed. True, bottle-feeding mamas and daddies can get just as close to their babies, but it takes a more conscious effort. There's always the understandable temptation to prop a bottle when you're busy or hand off feedings when you're tired.
Prepping for breastfeeding. Luckily, nature has worked out all the mechanics, so there's not much you'll need to do to get your breasts ready to feed your baby. Some lactation experts recommend that during the last months of pregnancy, you skip the soap on your nipples and areolas. Just rinse with water instead. Soap can dry the nipples, which may lead to cracking and soreness early in breastfeeding. If your nipples are dry, you can apply a lanolin-based cream such as Lansino. Otherwise, it's not necessary. The no-prep rule applies even to women with small or flat nipples. Flat nipples don't need to be prepped for nursing with breast shells, hand manipulation, or a manual breast pump during pregnancy. Not only are these prepping techniques often less effective than no treatment, but they can do more harm than good. The shells, besides being uncomfortably bulky, can cause sweating and rashes. Hand manipulation and ahead-of-time pumping can stimulate contractions and occasionally even trigger breast infection. Got pierced? You're all set to nurse your baby-to-be, but you're afraid there's a little something in the way. A nipple piercing. No worries. There's no evidence that nipple piercing has any effect on a mom's ability to breastfeed. Still, be sure to remove any nipple jewelry before baby opens wide and you insert your breast. This is not only due to the potential for infection for you, but because the jewelry could pose a choking hazard for your baby or injure his or her tender gums, tongue, or palate during feedings.
For dads, when father knows breast. Up until now, you've thought of your spouse's breasts sexually, and that's natural. But here's something that's also natural, and something you're probably well aware of already. Breasts are built the way they are for another good reason, and to serve another really important purpose, baby feeding. There is no more perfect food for an infant than breast milk, and no more perfect food delivery system than a breast. Make that two breasts. Breastfeeding offers an overwhelming number of health benefits for both babies, from preventing allergies, obesity, and illness to promoting brain development, and their moms. Nursing is linked to a speedier recovery postpartum, and a reduced risk of diabetes and of breast, ovarian, and uterine cancer later in life. Without a doubt, the decision to choose breast over bottle can make a dramatic difference in your baby's life, and in your partner's. And perhaps, surprisingly, your support in that decision can make a dramatic difference in breastfeeding success. So if you haven't already, give her your vote of breastfeeding confidence, which counts for a lot more than you'd think. Even though you may not know Let Down from Latch On yet, knowing that you're behind her every step of the way, especially when the going gets tough, which it often does at first, will have an enormous influence on whether mom sticks with breastfeeding. And the longer she sticks with it, the more health benefits for both her and baby. In fact, researchers have found that when dads are supportive of breastfeeding, moms are likely to give it a try 96% of the time. When dads are ambivalent, only about 26% give it a try. So take your influence seriously. Read up on breastfeeding, take a class together, talk to other dads whose partners have breastfed, and ask whether a lactation consultant, basically a nursing coach, will be available at the hospital or birthing center when baby's ready to chow down for the first time. Lesson one, it's a natural process, but it doesn't always come naturally. If your partner is hesitant to ask for help, or she's just too tired after delivery, be her breastfeeding advocate and make sure she gets it. Help get your spouse started, cheer her on, and then sit back and watch in wonder as those amazing breasts of hers take on one of life's most important and incredibly special jobs, baby feeding. Sure, it takes only two to breastfeed, but it often takes three to make it happen.
Breastfeeding after breast surgery. How does past breast surgery affect your breastfeeding future? That depends on what kind of surgery you had and how it was performed. Here's an overview. If you had a breast reduction or lumpectomy, you'll probably still be able to breastfeed, but you may not produce enough milk to nurse exclusively. Check with your surgeon to see if care was taken to preserve milk ducts and nerve pathways during the procedure. If so, chances are good that you'll be able to produce at least some milk. If you've had breast augmentation, your chances of being able to breastfeed successfully are good, since augmentation is less likely to interfere with breastfeeding than a breast reduction. Still, it will depend on the technique, the incision, and the reason why it was done. While many women with implants are able to nurse exclusively, a significant minority may not produce enough milk. No matter what kind of breast surgery you had, you can improve your chances of breastfeeding success by reading up, taking a class, and working with a lactation consultant right from the start. For much more, see what to expect the first year.
Making the choice to breastfeed. For more and more soon-to-be moms, the choice is clear. Some know they'll opt for breast over bottle long before they even decide to become pregnant. Others choose breastfeeding once they've heard its many benefits. Some teeter on the brink right through pregnancy and even delivery. And even those who are pretty convinced that nursing isn't for them still can't shake the nagging feeling that they should do it anyway. Undecided? Here's a suggestion. Try it. You might like it. You can always quit if you don't, but at least you will have cleared up those nagging doubts. Best of all, you and your baby will have reaped some of the most important benefits of breastfeeding, if only briefly. Just be sure to give breastfeeding a fair trial. The first few weeks can be challenging, even for the most enthusiastic breastfeeders, and are always a learning process, though getting lactation support can make things much easier if you're having a hard time. A full 4 to 6 weeks of nursing is generally needed to establish a successful feeding relationship and give mom the chance to figure out whether breast is best after all. Also keep in mind that breastfeeding isn't an all or nothing deal. For some moms, combining both breast and bottle is the best formula. For more on combining breast and bottle, see what to expect the first year.
When you can't or choose not to, breastfeed. Maybe you've decided that breastfeeding definitely isn't for you, or there's a reason why you won't be able to or end up not being able to breastfeed, either at all or exclusively. Either way, remember that you can offer your baby as much love and nurturing when you bottle feed as you can with breastfeeding. So reach for the formula without guilt or regret. To learn more about bottle feeding with love, see what to expect the first year. Chapter 13. The ninth month, approximately 36 to 40 weeks.
Finally, the month you've been waiting for, working towards, and stressing about just a little bit is here at long last. Chances are you're at once very ready to hold that baby, to see your toes again, to sleep on your stomach, and not ready at all. Still, despite the inevitable flurry of activity, more practitioner appointments, last-minute layette and gear items to shop for, projects to finish up at work, paint colors to pick for baby's room, you may find that the ninth month seems like the longest month of all. Except, of course, if you don't deliver by your due date. In that case, it's the 10th month that's the longest.
Your baby, the ninth month.
Week 36. Weighing somewhere around 6 pounds and measuring anywhere from 18 to 19 inches tall, your baby is almost ready to be served up into your arms. Right now, most of baby systems, from circulatory to musculoskeletal, are just about equipped for life on the outside. Though the digestive system is ready to roll too, it hasn't really gotten a workout yet. Remember, up until this point, your baby's nutrition has been arriving via the umbilical cord. No digestion necessary. But that's soon to change. As soon as your baby takes his or her first suckle at your breast or suck from the bottle, that digestive system will be jump-started and those diapers will start filling. Week 37. Here's some exciting news. If your baby were born this week, he or she would be considered full term. Mind you, that doesn't mean baby is finished growing or getting ready for life on the outside. Still gaining weight at about a half a pound a week, the average fetus's age weighs about 6.5 pounds, though size varies quite a bit from fetus to fetus, as it does from newborn to newborn. Fat continues to accumulate on your baby, forming kissable dimples in those cute elbows, knees, and shoulders, and adorable creases and folds in the neck and wrists. To keep busy until the big debut, your baby is practicing to make perfect, inhaling and exhaling amniotic fluid to get the lungs ready for that first breath, sucking on his or her thumb to prepare for that first suckle, blinking and pivoting from side to side, which explains why yesterday you felt that sweet little butt on the left side, and today it's taken a turn to the right. Week 38. Hitting the growth charts at about 7 pounds and the 20-inch mark, give or take an inch or two, your little one isn't so little anymore. In fact, baby's big enough for the big time and the big day. With only 2 or 4 max weeks left in utero, all systems are almost go. To finish getting ready for his or her close-up and all those photo ops, baby has a few last-minute details to take care of, like shedding the vernix, the greasy white substance protecting that tender new skin, and lanugo, the fine downy hair that covered your cutie's body for warmth. Baby's also producing more surfactant, which will prevent the air sacs in the lungs from sticking to each other when breathing begins. Your little one will be here before you know it. Week 39. Not much to report this week, at least in the height and weight department. Fortunately for you and your overstretched skin and aching back, baby's growth has slowed down or even taken a hiatus until after delivery. On average, a baby this week still weighs in at about between 7 and 8 pounds, the size of a baby, and measures 19 to 21 inches, so yours may be a little bigger or smaller. Still, progress is being made in some other areas, especially baby's brain, which is growing and developing up a storm at a rapid pace that will continue during the first 3 years of life. What's more, your baby's pink skin has turned whitish or whitish gray, no matter what skin your baby will ultimately be in, since pigmentation doesn't occur until soon after birth. A development that you may have noticed by now if this is your first pregnancy, baby's head might have dropped into your pelvis. This change of baby's locale might make for easier breathing and less heartburn, but could also make it harder for you to walk. Make that waddle. Week 40. Congratulations, you've reached the official end of your pregnancy, and maybe the end of your rope. For the record, your baby is fully full term and could weigh in anywhere from between the 6 and 9 pound mark and measure anywhere from 19 to 22 inches, though some perfectly healthy babies check in slightly smaller or bigger than that. You may notice when your baby emerges that he or she, and you'll know for sure which at that momentous moment, is still curled into the fetal position, even though the fetal days are over. That's just sheer force of habit. After spending 9 months in the cramped confines of your uterus, your baby doesn't yet realize there's room to spread out now. And comfort, that snug-as-a-bug position, feels good. When you do meet your new arrival, be sure to say hello, and more. Though it's your first face-to-face, your baby will recognize the sound of your voice and that of dad's. And if baby doesn't arrive on time, choosing to ignore the due date on your app, you're in good, if impatient, company. About 30% of all pregnancies proceed past the 40-week mark, though, thankfully, your practitioner will probably not let yours continue beyond 42 weeks. Weeks 41 to 42. So, looks like baby has opted for a late checkout. Fewer than 5% of babies are born on their actual due date, and around 10% decide to overstay their welcome in hotel uterus beyond week 41. Thriving well into the 10th month, though you may have lost that thriving feeling long ago. Remember, too, that most of the time, an overdue baby isn't overdue at all. It's just that the due date was off. Less often, a baby may be truly post-mature. When a post-mature baby does make a debut, it's often with dry, cracked, peeling, loose, and wrinkled skin. All completely temporary. Soft new baby skin is soon to follow. That's because the protective vernix was shed weeks before in anticipation of a delivery date that's since come and gone. An older fetus will also have longer nails, possibly longer hair, and definitely little or none of that baby fuzz lanugo at all. In general, postmature newborns tend to be more alert and open-eyed. After all, they're older and wiser. Just to be sure all is well, your practitioner will likely monitor your overdue baby closely through non-stress tests and checks of the amniotic fluid or biophysical profiles.
Your body, the 9th month.
In your last month of pregnancy symptoms, some may be lingering from last month, while others may be brand new. Still others may hardly be noticeable because you're so used to them, or because they are eclipsed by new and more exciting signs indicating that labor may not be far off. Physically. Changes in fetal activity, more squirming and less kicking as your baby has progressively less room to move around. Vaginal discharge becomes heavier and contains more mucus, which may be streaked red with blood or tinged brown or pink after sex or a pelvic exam or as your cervix begins to dilate. Constipation or looser stools as labor nears. Heartburn, indigestion, flatulence, bloating. Occasional headaches. Occasional lightheadedness or dizziness, especially when getting up quickly or when your blood sugar dips. Nasal congestion and occasional nosebleeds, ear stuffiness, sensitive gums, leg cramps at night, increased backache and heaviness, buttock and pelvic discomfort and achiness, increased swelling of ankles and feet, and occasionally of hands and face, itchy belly, protruding navel, a popped-out belly button, stretch marks, varicose veins in the legs and or vulva, hemorrhoids, easier breathing after baby drops, more frequent urination after baby drops since there's pressure on the bladder once again, increased difficulty sleeping, more frequent and more intense Braxton Hicks contractions, some may be painful, increasing clumsiness and difficulty getting around, colostrum leaking from your nipples, though this premilk substance may not appear until after delivery. Extra fatigue or extra energy, nesting syndrome, or alternating periods of each. Increase in appetite or loss of appetite. Emotionally, more excitement, more anxiety, more apprehension, more absent-mindedness. Relief that you're almost there. Irritability and oversensitivity, especially with people who keep saying, "No baby yet." Impatience and restlessness, dreaming and fantasizing about the baby.
Your body this month. Your uterus is right under your ribs now, and your measurements aren't really changing that much from week to week anymore. The top of your uterus is around 38 to 40 centimeters from the top of your pubic bone. Your weight gain slows down or even stops as D-Day approaches. Your abdominal skin is stretched as far as you think it can go, and you're probably waddling more now than ever, possibly because the baby has dropped in anticipation of impending labor. If you'd like to see any of the illustrations from this chapter, you can download and print out a special PDF from the same Audible page where you purchased your audiobook. What you can expect at the 9th month checkup.
With appointments scheduled weekly this month, you'll be spending more time than ever at your practitioner's office. These visits will be more interesting. The practitioner will estimate baby size and may even venture a prediction about how close you are to delivery, with the excitement growing as you approach the big day. In general, you can expect your practitioner to check the following. Your weight. Gain generally slows down or stops. Your blood pressure, it may be slightly higher than it was at mid-pregnancy. Your urine for protein. Your feet and hands for swelling, and legs for varicose veins. Your cervix, the neck of your uterus, by internal examination to see if effacement thinning and dilation opening have begun. The height of the fundus. The fetal heartbeat. Fetal size, you may get a rough weight estimate. Presentation, head or buttocks first. Position, front or rear facing, and descent. Is the presenting part engaged in the pelvis yet? By palpation, feeling with the hands. Questions and concerns you want to discuss, particularly those related to labor and delivery, have a list ready. You can also expect to receive a labor and delivery protocol from your practitioner, when to call if you think you're in labor, when to plan on heading to the hospital or birthing center. If you don't, be sure to ask for those instructions. You'll need them.
What you may be wondering about, the 9th month.
Urinary frequency, again.
During the last few days, it seems like I'm in the bathroom constantly. Is it normal to be peeing this often now?
Having a first trimester flashback? That's because your uterus is right back where it started, down low in your pelvis, pressing squarely on your bladder. And this time,